Back up Bagatha. The violinist was Max Hobart with the Boston Pops Orchestra, conducted by Arthur Fiedler. Well, that's it from me, Rob Cowan, for this Sunday morning. I hope you'll be able to join me again next week, same time, 9 o'clock, and for a special Portraits Day edition of Essential Classics tomorrow at 9.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3. Studio production this morning was by Neil Miners. And indeed, yes, tomorrow all day on Radio 3 we'll be taking a very close look at many faces.
Chairman Mao.
So you can see.
Louis Armstrong.
It is a wonderful world.
I'm very pleased to be here today.
Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother.
On behalf of Her Majesty the Queen.
BBC Radio 3 presents Portraits Day, a bank holiday celebration of musical portraits. Over 100 people, some famous, many unknown, who have been captured in music. From Petrarch Trelawney at breakfast to late-night jazz on 3. Join us for Portraits Day, starting tomorrow morning at 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, Shakespeare features prominently today on Radio 3 in our Sunday feature later this evening, and also drama on 3, a new production at that, of The Tempest. But we begin in an hour from now when Lucy Skeapin considers the career of Shakespeare's regular musical collaborator, Robert Johnson. That's the early music show at 1 o'clock. Next, this lunchtime though on Radio 3 with a time at midday, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Paddy Ashdown served in the Royal Marines and then worked in intelligence and diplomacy. He was elected leader of the Liberal Democrats in 1988, a post he held for 11 years, during which time the fortunes of the party prospered. He was knighted in 2000 and the following year became a life peer. He's a vigorous contributor to debates about foreign policy and, of course, the role of the Liberal Democrats. Funnily enough, Paddy, sitting exactly in that chair just 2 or 3 years ago was Nick Clegg. And he was very open about, when I said to him, what are the prospects and things, of course he was optimistic, but I don't think in his wildest dreams he would have thought that he would be a Deputy Prime Minister today.
No, not in my wildest dreams. By the way, Michael, I was deeply envious of him. This is a programme I've wanted to do, and I'm a Radio 3 listener for as long as I've been listening to it. And here was Nick Clegg, who was on before me. How could he manage that? Anyway, look, none of us recognised that this would be what would happen. But when I was leader of the Lib Dems, I always said to them, there's no point in being a liberal if you're just some sort of furry little herbivore on the edges of British politics, acting as a think tank. Yeah, there's only one point of being in politics, and that is to be in government and to inform the government of the nation you serve with the principles that you believe in. And so this was, in many ways, the dream I hoped the party would achieve when I was the founding leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Does the whole sort of principle of coalition politics necessarily mean that you're going to disappoint people? Because you have to be pragmatic.
The whole principle of government necessarily means you're going to disappoint people. I mean, you know, that's the reason we get rid of them. And, you know, the mistakes that have been made by and large good governments. I mean, I fought Mrs. Thatcher, but she was the outstanding prime minister of my time. But eventually they were in power too long, got corrupted. I don't mean in any other sense than in their approach to the way that they did things. I don't mean sort of corrupted in the more venal sense, in any venal sense. The same happened to Blair. So we get rid of governments because they lose their purpose and they lose their way. And in the process, by doing things that are necessary for the country, they make themselves unpopular and they will disappoint many people. But here's the central question. What is the purpose of politics if not to serve your country, even if the consequence is that it damages your party? Now, by the way, I think that what we're doing now, it would deliver no dividend. Anybody who believed this would deliver an early dividend for the party simply didn't understand politics. It's not going to deliver a dividend until about a year before the election, when people will think, hang on, these guys have acted effectively in partnership with others and hopefully have led us through very difficult times. Those times may not be over. And we will get the dividend for that. But even if that were not to happen, and by the way, I believe it will, but even if that were not to happen, if we went through 4 years of government, serving our country, applying a good, steady government at a time of real national crisis because of the economic situation we're in, and the consequence was the party was damaged in the outcome, I would say, fine, but we fulfilled our purpose, and I'd accept that. I think most of the party would, by the way.
You spoke about the ideals of government, in a sense, and funnily enough, the first composer is somebody I think you profoundly respect because of the nobility of intent.
I came to classical music, which is one of the sustaining joys of my life, completely by accident. My mother had a fine voice. She introduced me to classical music. Her favourite piece of music was Beethoven's Fourth Piano Concerto. But at the age of 11, I first heard the Pastoral Symphony walking through my prep school. And I was just bowled over. Since when, you know, Beethoven is the composer nonpareil, the composer who, for me, is the very greatest. One of the key moments of this was when I came to late Beethoven. At the age of 18, brought there by a man I respected very much called Quentin Skinner, Professor Emeritus of something or other at Oxford, and a very fine man. He introduced me to Opus 110 and 11. And then after that, of course, the late quartets. If I was asked, what is the last piece of music you'd like to hear? It would be this, because, and you said it yourself, there is nobility, it seems to me, in every note of Beethoven. There is genius in every note of Mozart, but nobility, and even the bagatelles. And this piece of music, on the face of it potentially sad, nevertheless has all the nobility of the human spirit tied up in it. And it is the last piece of music I'd like to hear.
Thank you.
The old cliche, of course, that how could he have composed that when deaf? I mean, it is extraordinary. But what I think is more extraordinary is I understand, I was listening the other day to a programme that said when his deafness started, he tended to compensate by using notes higher up in the register, but not lower because he couldn't hear those. But at this stage, he's using the full range, and there are so many low notes in there that he must have been doing it entirely from imagination, which is musically an extraordinary thing.
The Quartetto Italiano played the second movement from the String Quartet No. 12 in E-flat, Opus 127, by Beethoven. Now, Paddy Ashton, as somebody who's had frontline experience of warfare, you are, interestingly, somebody who is, I won't just say nervous, but quite passionate about the idea of all-out war being something you very much are against and that you would prefer to see things done subtly and stealth.
I think we'd all prefer to see that. I recognise, however, that all-out war from time to time is a baleful product of our age. And can you say necessary? I'm not sure you can. But how could we not have fought an all-out war when we had one launched against us by Hitler in 1939? For me, however, one of the reasons I went into special forces was, oddly enough, because I found it a more congenial way of doing warfare than the absolute violence that is necessary in active service. Now, that may sound odd, but somehow or other you're doing it by guile or by different means that involve, may I use the word intelligence? Let me use it anyway, cunning, perhaps, more than the application of brute force. Interestingly enough, Michael, I'm just writing the 70th anniversary of the great Cockleshell Hero Raid on Bordeaux in December 1942, the hero of which, of course, is the remarkable man Blondie Hasler, who led the 10 Marines into the Gironde. And he felt exactly the same way. He went to do special forces precisely because he found it a way to avoid the absolute violence required by all other warfare.
I mention this because I think the next piece of music,
yeah, it is.
Was something was important to you when you were facing.
Well, it is. I mean, I believe in God? Yes, but if any, I'm an Irishman. My mother was a Protestant. My father was a Catholic, brought up in Northern Ireland. If somebody asked me, you know, what religion I had, I suppose I'd say Christianity, chiefly because I find it is most conducive to the country, the age, and the place in which I live. I could as easily be a Muslim, frankly, if I was brought up in a Muslim community. In fact, for the first 4 years of my life, I was brought up by Muslims when my father was away behind Japanese lines and my mother was down waiting for him. So Christian is as far as I'd go, if you ask me to go further than that. And I don't go to church. Northern Ireland drive churches out of me. However, I do have a sense of God. And this piece of music, Janet Baker, a particular line that he shall assist me to look higher, convinces me of that more than anything else. It's funny how music will bring a picture to your mind. On this occasion, the picture it brings to mind was, I'm 18, I'm on the commando carrier HMS Bulwark, thundering up the Persian Gulf in bright sunlight and I guess 40 degrees of heat. And we're about to go into Kuwait, the first Kuwait crisis of 1960, or was it 61? 60, I think. And I am about to lead my Marines into what I'm told is active service against a highly superior enemy, numerically vastly superior enemy, the following day. Fortunately, they'd gone away by the time we got there, but I wasn't to know that. And standing on the deck of HMS Bulwark on a Sunday, thundering up the Persian Gulf with action in prospect for the first time the following day, I listened to Sunday at Sea, the Sunday service on the quarterdeck. And this brings that back to me, but especially that great line sung with such extraordinary appropriateness by Janet Baker, "He shall assist me to look higher."
Oh.
Don't you think there's almost nobody who can set a human voice better than Elgar? And, of course, who else could sing that but Janet Baker? It's that quality about that which I think only she can reach, the Elgar Sea Songs. And I love that line, you know, God's spirit shall give comfort. It seems to me that a belief in God of one sort or another, rather inchoate belief as far as I'm concerned, does two things of supreme value. The first is to give comfort at difficult times, and the second is to govern your life according to the principle that there is always the possibility of redemption for yourself and for others. Whether it's true is a different matter, but to govern your life according to that principle, both in your own behaviour and in the behaviour of others, seems to me a profoundly important compass needle to follow.
Sabbath Morning at Sea from Sea Pictures Opus 37 by Elgar, Janet Baker with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by James Loughran. Given what you were doing when that music meant so much to you, Paddy Ashton, it might be just briefly a nice moment to talk about the fact that, because you have very strong feelings about this, that, you know, in the last decade or so we've had Iraq, and of course you actually got on quite well with Tony Blair. You had a good working relationship, from what I gather. We've had Libya, and we're now, what do we do about Syria? You have very strong feelings about intervention.
Look, I think you are the product of your experiences. And remember, that is often the case, that we run the next war according to the experiences of the last. I think, you know, it's hubris that nearly always gets you in the end, and it's hubris that got Tony Blair. He thought that the success of first Kosovo and then Sierra Leone could be repeated in Iraq. My experience of this comes from Bosnia. I first visited Bosnia in 1992, became obsessed by it. Went back during the siege, I don't know, a dozen times, I suppose, and eventually, of course, became a high representative there. And over all of those 4 years of slaughter, I was calling for intervention. And when it happened, we crushed the murder in days. And so that's where I come from. I think I come from a different position as well, Michael, which is this. I think we are moving into a deeply turbulent age, an age in which power shifts. I think we're actually reaching the beginning of the end of 400 years of the domination of Western power, Western institutions, and maybe even Western values. We're going to have to share the world with other power structures. These are always bloody and turbulent times when power shifts in the world. Think of when power shifted across the Atlantic to the new state of the United States of America, the beginning of the American century, and the two great cataclysms that occurred in the vacuum where the old European wars, powers were of the First and Second World War. So these are going to be turbulent and bloody times. I think our capacity on behalf of the international community to intervene in the domestic jurisdiction of another state to preserve the wider peace, where it's sensible to do so and possible to do so, will be likely to make a more turbulent age less so. And for that reason, I think it needs to be done. But it needs to be done properly. And what is very clear to me is that in Iraq, and arguably just as much in Afghanistan, we have done it improperly. We've made every mistake in the book. And I think the consequence, therefore, for us and for the poor bloody infantry we've put in harm's way, whose lives I think we have in many cases wasted, are very grave. If you do it, you must do it properly. And I wrote a book about how I thought that could happen after my experiences in Bosnia. So maybe Libya, maybe standing back, not making the victory our victory, but enabling it to be their victory, maybe not imposing all our systems and values and institutions on them, but letting them create their own, even if that creates chaos, as in Libya, is a better way of doing it than trying to do everything ourselves, as we did in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is, anyway, it seems to me, quite an arrogant approach to these things.
We had a consummate contralto, and we're now going to move to a soprano at the top of her game. And, of course, this composer raises all sorts of interesting thoughts,
absolutely,
doesn't it? Somebody who was involved, absolutely, to a certain extent in Hitler's Germany, and yet wrote music, like Wagner, that transcended the things we might hold against him.
Well, absolutely. And this piece in particular, this, of course, is one of Strauss's four last songs, Richard Strauss. I'm not a terrific Strauss fan. I mean, I would nearly have had the wonderful Countess's song at the end of Rosenkavalier. But here's the reason I love this, for a number of reasons. First of all, this was the Lion of Vienna in 1910. He writes this in 1947, 48. having, as you rightly said, been far too close to Hitler, the celebration, it seems to me, of life, even at the end of it, I'm going to ask you to play the third of the four last songs of Strauss, sung by Schwarzkopf. Who else could sing this? Nobody else does it as well. In which the last line, Tief und tausendfach zu leben, which is to live life a thousand times more deeply. Now imagine writing that at 80-something or other as your last piece on earth.
And having seen his world completely
absolutely,
shattered.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dresden. And
yeah, no, we were talking about images when you play music. I remember listening to this going across on the Eurostar, the battlefields of northern France, which, of course, Strauss would have seen as well. And the tears were just rolling down my face. All the sadness that's associated with the music, all the extraordinary life close to death, and the hunger for life, but still the redemption. Having gone through the period of Nazism, which he was far too, as we said, too much involved with, and many people's eyes besmirched by, nevertheless, still able to strike something completely sublime.
Thank you.
The way that he takes that voice off the violin and just soars it up towards heaven is extraordinary.
And the confidence of actually giving the violin that long solo. But it's completely right. And then the horn solo at the end,
absolutely.
Too, which somehow just is the icing on the cake.
Absolutely. And it has to be sung by somebody with a very mature voice. And there are lots of others who have done it as well. But for my mind, I think Schwarzkopf is the only person who can really pull that off to that extent.
Beim Schlafengehen from Four Last Songs by Richard Strauss. We heard Elisabeth Schwarzkopf with the Radio Symphony Orchestra of Berlin, conducted by George Sell. We are dealing with quite a few creative geniuses here, aren't we? Because we come on now to perhaps... Well, as you said, that Beethoven was the most noble in a sense, but Mozart has a Shakespearean grip on life. There's less turbulence in the music, but there's a kind of wisdom about the way he observes humanity and all its doings.
Yeah, there is, but I will now make myself an enemy of every Mozart lover. And God knows there are far too many millions, even for a liberal, to make enemies of. But he is intensely observant about, it seems to me, the frivolities of life. Now, frivolity has a huge place in life, and, you know, a person without a sense of humour isn't living. And he certainly had that. You have this sense of this impudent observer. And that's what differentiates him from Beethoven. But enough of that. Who am I to be a judge of these things? Suffice it to say that no selection of music would be complete.